Welcome to RPGnomics, an investigation of the games we love and the business that allows them to exist. My guest today is the person behind a number of games you may or may not have played, and several I have played at least once. Jason Pitt of Genesis of Legend, also the voice and brains partially behind the RPG Design Paddlecast, quite simply one of the best RPG theory podcasts that I have ever heard. And more importantly, it adds in a bunch of stuff on tabletop miniatures and board games, so we could see all the cool stuff RPGs could do if we were 10 times larger. So, Jason, how are you doing? And what is the most recent project that is out in the world that our listeners can go buy if they want to?
All right. So, thank you for having me. Jason Pitt, behind Genesis of Legend Publishing. And the most recent products we've got out are probably Sig City of Blades, which is our effectively smashing together Planescape-style planar fantasy with Blades in the Dark heists. So you're playing factions that are trying to steal territory from each other in this bizarre planar nexus city. So that's a lot of fun.
And if you would like to learn more about that, my other show, Mage the Podcast, did a wonderful interview with Jason describing the number of games that you've had where you're like, but what if more Planescape, but system gooder? And more philosophy. And I think you have a sequence of games that very much answer that question.
Pretty much. And I have also been stewarding Noir World.
Oh, really?
Yes, which is a film noir powered by the Apocalypse game by John Adamus. He was dealing with some health challenges, so I've been helping him close that project out. So there are copies available.
Yeah, I have one behind me. I did not know that had your imprimatur behind it.
I did the layout and a lot of the printing.
And both of those are available, I believe, on DriveThruRPG, and links to those will be in the show notes. Today's topic, though, we're going to discuss something you have been kind of in the vanguard of having a non-hot take opinion of, which is the world of procedural AI or generative art. There's a number of terms that can be used behind it. Most recently, Midjourney, which is the name of a company that has produced a product that is frequently just referred to as Midjourney, which takes a text input through a Discord bot and generates an output of some sort. And sometimes it is freakish and sometimes it is sublime. And most of the time you're like, that's pretty good. I kind of see what you did there. And the internet has been swarming with hot takes regarding that, and some lukewarm takes and some well-informed takes. And we're going to see what we can do with that. But first, let's define some of what this Midjourney is. Midjourney itself, as I mentioned, is the name of the research lab. One of the people behind it was actually behind Leap Motion. And the company is apparently already profitable. I'm curious to see what that actually means. They generated a tool, often referred to as Midjourney, that is an open beta that you can access through their Discord. Links to that will also be in the show notes. It is similar to DALL-E, or in this case, more accurately, DALL-E 2. It takes in large amounts of described images and goes through a process of trying to create an engine by which it will generate an image from a text prompt. The way it does this is through what is known as a diffusion learning, where you take an image, add random noise to it, and the computer learns to systematically remove that noise to get something very close to the original image. It does successive passes to get closer and closer to a target piece, and then has some sort of grading function that basically says, how close did you get? It does this hundreds of millions, likely billions, possibly trillions of times, to build up a library of gradients and filters that basically say, from random noise, what will get me closest to the prompt that was given. The goal of this is to come up with something that is high quality in that it generates an image that is indistinguishable from other elements in the class. If you train it on cars, you want to be able to put in a car prompt and get something where someone goes, that's a car. It should also have mode coverage and sample diversity, as in a good model should capture and reproduce the diversity of input images without increasing errors. So it is not good enough to just have trained it on cars and to put in an arbitrary car descriptor and get out the same car every time. You want it to be able to reproduce the diversity of inputs that it received in some way, shape, or form. And there is a trade-off between storage, computation, and speed. These models are often rendered down into billions or trillions of parameters, which are measured in gig and terabytes, depending on the nature of those parameters. The benefit of this diffusion learning method is that it is scalable and parallelizable, meaning you can make the model bigger pretty easily to make it encompass more stuff, Also, you can make it go faster by throwing more processor resources at it, which is when you or I submit a thing to Midjourney, I imagine it is shopping it out to an EC2 instance that is using an NVIDIA GPU to reply to that thing. This is kind of a successor to GAN, Generative Adversarial Networks, and overcomes a number of the problems that they have. And I'm curious kind of to see what happens when the two run into each other.
So there's a few more aspects to this that are worth mentioning.
Shoot.
One, they currently have a very large Discord server, and they have unlocked APIs so that you can actually include Midjourney in other instances. They're doing some pretty heavy work on trying to improve the model. And one of the ways that they are actually profitable now is everyone in the beta gets a certain amount of free images. You get a significantly larger number if you pay $10 a month. And if you pay $30 a month, you get unlimited. So that is not inconsiderable when you look at the size of the Discord server itself, which is 1,856,000 members. So no, it's not a surprise that it's profitable at this point. $10 a month times that.
And even if we presume something like 1%, it then becomes a question of the economics of adding things into it and what those instances are to run. Cheap computing is part of what has made this possible. Another interesting thing to note, though, as we mentioned, is because of the technology it uses, it starts with a random seed. When you give it a prompt, it goes to some source of entropy, comes up with a field of Gaussian random noise, and just starts saying, is this close to the prompt? Is this close to the prompt? And it does a certain number of passes until it gets within a certain error function of what it thinks the appropriate image should look like. When you upsample, which is one of the options, you say, run a bunch more passes. And that functionally gives you additional resolution. So it's partially interesting that you can get an arbitrary level of detail, which I find to be fascinating. And also the fact that kind of the starting canvas is literally a sheet of random noise, which kind of raises interesting concerns unto its own. And let's kind of talk about some of the concerns with it. These are kind of some of the ones that I have run into. One of the things I find interesting is kind of the algorithmic bias. For instance, in some of the early things, a friend and I were fascinated by how well it captured certain aspects of culture. We were able to put in major life events, wedding, funeral, holiday celebration, and a state in India, and got reasonable responses. It was able to show a party that may look that looked like it occurred in Gujarat versus may have occurred in Uttar Pradesh or Maharashtra. And that was pretty impressive. The problem was when we started asking it for things like Indian attorney or Indian doctor, all of the outputs were heavily gendered, in that all of them were male or masculine presenting for traditionally masculine jobs. The moment I said female Indian lawyer, I did get what appeared to be a female Indian lawyer. But this is a case where the computer is kind of giving us our own biases back. DALL-E 2 ran into a similar problem where they tried to remove all images depicting violence, which interestingly resulted in fewer women in most of the randomized output testing. And I'm like, that's concerning. The problem then becomes we have these images which kind of give people an idea of what the world looks like, which then further recapitulates that kind of bias. I also find it interesting that without additional prompts, the generic people it generates are of a certain type. There seems to be this omnipresent late 30s, early 40s, dark-haired, long-haired woman that is frequently what I would refer to as Miss Midjourney or something like that, that kind of becomes the norm. It is seemingly incapable of showing fat people or women of color with long hair, which makes it on par with RPG art, he said scathingly.
So there's a lot of aspects to that. One of which is prompt craft is a legitimate, unique skill. It's actually a art direction skill, but not one that is often prioritized or recognized.
Define prompt craft first, if you could, for people who may not have used Midjourney before.
Typically, what you are doing with AI art specifically is that you are giving a line or two worth of text. The AI tries to parse that text and determine what that actually is trying to represent. So, for instance, if you say a long-haired Nigerian woman at a wedding, I said a long-haired Nigerian woman instead of saying a long-haired woman. And that shifted certain factors. So if I say a long-haired Nigerian woman instead of a long-haired woman, I'm more likely to get someone who is of darker complexion. I'm more likely to get certain fashion aspects that are associated with that specific nation. So that being aware of what words you want to explicitly include and not assume are going to happen is vital for getting good quality products.
And just like some people are good at Google, they are good at crafting requests such that you can differentiate between things. So for instance, I found it very difficult to find information about the type of artificial intelligence model or machine learning model that Midjourney was using. I put in Midjourney AI model, and I got information about the pricing model that they were using or the current edition that they were putting out. So I had to add additional terms like machine learning, and that didn't quite get me there. So I put in a bunch of different known machine learning models, and then I got the information back in the two interviews where the creator has said, hey, we use this diffusion learning model, which was only available in like text transcript from this like investor call or something like that. So in the same way that crafting a Google query is a skill, it is here. And some people are very good at figuring out what those qualifiers are, as well as ordering the sentence. There is something like a language model, but it's not necessarily parsing it in the same way that you and I would parse a prepositional phrase. So for instance, saying a person on fire, you and I would parse that as being a person alight as opposed to a person sitting on a flame, which is another way of parsing on fire. So everything that goes with language interpretation is also being piled on top of this. There are additional keywords and modifiers that can be used, for instance, including a style type like energetic, neon, noir, 4K, realistic, rendered, and so on. And some people have gotten quite good at that. There are additional technical parameters you can do where you can say, do this many passes or do this many additional passes and so on, or this is the aspect ratio I want, or this is how I want the different parts weighed to kind of combine them into a resultant style. And some people are quite good at that. And even within my own Discord, there are a few people that seem to already be Midjourney whisperers. I thought those people were just preternaturally good at it, but then I go to their Midjourney pages, you can view what other users have created, and you just see the hundreds of test queries they have done to dial that in. So for instance, currently on the Midjourney mage page is a depiction of a Black or African version of Wonder Woman. And you click on that and you see the 200 queries the person did to get to that amazing thing. And additionally, as we mentioned, Midjourney starts with Gaussian noise. So every time you run it, even with the same prompt, since it uses a different seed, you may get a different image to result in that. So part of it is just running it a couple more times. And it does have a variant feature that gets kind of close to that.
So in terms of query craft, one of the things that I appreciate is it's forced me to actually dig into art history, because going with something that is a impressionist piece, an impressionist landscape versus a Baroque landscape versus an Art Nouveau landscape, these produce very different things. And these are the kinds of things that you would actually want as an art director. The main competitive advantage with an artist, an actual human artist, is that humans are able to handle fuzzy logic situations and have a vast repertoire of knowledge. So I communicated to one of my artists, I want a Renaissance Italy female Iron Man. That was the entirety of the art direction I gave her. And she parsed that perfectly, beating up some Florentine sword-wielding bandits with a crossbow mounted on her arm. Like, yes, this is what I wanted. Perfect. It would probably take me 3 hours worth of tinkering to actually produce a similar style of image on Midjourney, because it can't handle, it doesn't understand the meaning, it understands the words.
So far, sometimes it is kind of impressive. The Raven Matrix, intelligence matrix, is a common test used to see people's pattern matching abilities. And DALL-E does pretty good at it in tests. So for now, it does acceptable. But you're right, a human artist is certainly going to be able to fill in a lot more details.
And you can also go in and look at the specific prompts that are used by other people, which is particularly fascinating. And you can see their logic that is used. You can see certain key terms that are used. I'm actually a big fan of using terms such as golden ratio or two-thirds ratio. You know, the standard things that are used, you know, two-point perspective. By using certain technical terms like that, you can direct the AI down certain technical paths. But it takes time and experience to be able to use it effectively. Now, these are very different skills from skills that artists use. And we need to recognize that. The people who are just entering prompts are not artists per se. They're art directors. While we have to respect art directors, it's a different beast. Now, paintovers are a thing that arise frequently. And I think that's actually the most promising use of the tech. Paintovers are whereby you generate effectively the foundation of your piece, and then you start actually using art tools, Photoshop, Affinity Designer, whatever. Krita is a good one. Modifying the image, fixing the weird hands in this one. I'm going to take the character from this one and use this background from the other one. Now I'm going to go through and try to regularize the tones and get the lighting correct. And effectively, you take the first draft from an AI, and then you use actual artistic skill to refine that and turn it into a publish-worthy product.
We've talked about the difficulty of prompt craft. Another kind of thing that is hanging over it is, what is the copyright status of what it has been trained on? Some models publicly publish what they have been trained on. And in some cases, they are scrupulous to say, hey, we only did Creative Commons CC0, public domain, submitted images, or some things that are sometimes viewed as acceptable, such as like a 128 by 128 thumbnail of something. So sometimes, for instance, the DALL-E 2 publishes its data set that it was trained on, or at least links to it. I don't know of Midjourney having done that. And some people have done some interesting investigations where they say, put this in the style of blank. And you kind of get some things like the artist's watermark or something else that indicates that maybe that this wasn't okay. Another common one is the fact that it tore through ArtStation. So the question is, we do not yet have clear law on what it is to use a copyrighted work necessarily as an input. But certainly this is something that has ethical and possibly legal questions regarding it.
So one thing to question is, was it that artist's wordmark or a wordmark that was produced, where most artists tend to put wordmarks in the colors used by most artists for wordmarks? I think literally you could bypass that entire thing by saying no wordmark. And it would say, oh, don't add the wordmark element that artists use as part of art. Okay. It treats a wordmark just as it would a background piece or a tree or whatever. It's the same thing. It's just, it's a thing that tends to show up for some reason. But yeah, no, the question of what is the training data? How was that chosen? How is that curated? How much consent was acquired? It's uncertain. I really appreciate that there are some models that are going out of their way to explicitly choose clean data sets. But it's also the fact that there is a spectrum of originality in art. It goes from, on one extreme, completely creating this piece of art from scratch, to looking at collecting 5 or 6 different reference images and drawing something new based on those, to using one reference image and trying to recreate it with your own skills, to I'm trying to trace it and then derive it and grow it from there, to I'm literally copying it and changing a few details and passing it off as my own.
And there have been times in the RPG world that kind of image hacking has been brought up, where there was a notable Kickstarter that was brought down by the fact that one of their keystone pieces of art was stylistically copied from another. That is something that I feel personally odd about, because if you're strictly using it as a pose reference, it seems odd for that to be the case. I mean, especially in the RPG world, where we almost never include colophons listing inspirations and sources. Almost never is too strong, where it is not uncommon to not indicate where you got an idea from, because it is frequently that where did this come from is a little bit different. There are 3 different mechanics that are called momentum. They all kind of act as a ballast system towards the action of the game, but they're all different in implementation. They all look very different. They are stylistically not the same, even if they kind of point in the same direction, in the same way that if you have a statistic that is functionally a gas tank that when it is depleted, your character dies. I don't know that we need to cite back to the genesis of the notion to health levels or hit points, but it is one of those things where there is both a formal mechanism where you said, hey, you copied my work, I'm suing you for copyright infringement, and informal mechanisms that say, hey, don't support this person's work, they did this thing to me, and this is not an ethical thing to do. And we will talk kind of about both avenues of that.
But basically, there's a spectrum, and we're still trying to figure out exactly where some of these AI tools land on that spectrum. Because if I am literally taking someone else's image, let's, for instance, I take one sketch that is a body from a character and one sketch that is a head from another character. I stitch them together with a background made by a third person. That's not really original. That's kind of far on one end. By contrast, if I just say, hey, I am going to look at 100 different photos of dragons. I'm going to try to understand what those dragons are doing. What dragons tend to have wings? They tend to have muzzles like this. Let's post a couple of these, look at them occasionally, and now I'm going to draw my own dragon. That's fine if it's a human. Where do we draw the line? I see a lot of people who are saying that it's effectively doing collages of existing pieces of art. From my understanding of the technical aspects of this, the database itself does not actually contain any art. It contains, functionally, this is what a dragon kind of looks like. Here's some dragon-ish traits. So if someone says dragon, apply this model and do things that are dragon-ish.
And the fact that it starts literally with random noise kind of suggests to me that saying just collage is questionable, unless your definition of collage includes the idea that all works that contain International Klein Blue are collages of works that happen to include International Klein Blue. That is a definition of collage that I think at that point is questionable. That is like saying that all photographs are merely the collage of a rainbow, which is poetic, but I don't think useful in terms of litigation.
Yeah. There is, conversely, the ability to ape styles, which can be problematic.
But is fascinating.
Is fascinating.
You put in emo dragon in the style of Egon Schiele, you will get something in many cases that looks remarkably like a German abstract, a representation of a lizard that would be very comfortable at a My Chemical Romance concert. Just putting that out there.
They actually do daily art prompts. If you're in this channel, you have to create things that use certain words or certain art prompts. One of them was Studio Ghibli, and you could see incredible varieties of Studio Ghibli cyberpunk, Studio Ghibli Pokemon, Studio Ghibli a group of friends having a beer in the style of Studio Ghibli. Let's see what it does. So you can understand what is the essence of Ghibliness, which is fascinating. And I mean, I personally have zero problem with saying in the style of Rembrandt, in the style of Van Gogh. There's no problem with that. It's where you say in the style of Geiger. Okay, fairly recent. Like the estate's kicking around. In the style of Todd Lockwood. Okay, he's around. He's doing art right now. So where do you draw that line? Because if you say, AI, I want you to imitate a living artist so that I don't have to pay that living artist, that's where it gets real sketch. Especially if that artist was not okay with their works being used as reference pieces to train this program up. There are some artists who are fully engaged and supportive of AI art. And wonderful. Peter Mulchbacher, how do you pronounce that name?
Morbacher,
yes.
Okay.
He is a vocal supporter of AI art and Midjourney.
Creator of Angelarium. Yeah. And just to note, Egon Schiele was Austrian. Apologies. So
I have no problem using his art style in the style of him, because he's clearly given his consent. But there's a number of other people that know they are living artists who do not agree that an AI should be able to effectively copy them and deprive them of a source of income. Yeah, that's a thing.
It is interesting to me because there are two ends to that. One is either the AI is not good enough to perfectly emulate their style, in which case it's not actually copying them. When we say Todd Lockwood, that is a shortcut for a number of descriptors one could use. In the same way that, for instance, I could say, I feel like I could come up with a list of descriptors that would get me to Titian or Rembrandt, possibly. So, for instance, if you put in Dutch masters, in a lot of cases, you're going to wind up getting something that would just kind of repeat that. But at the same time, time, as we were talking earlier, there is probably a Todd Lockwoodness that the model is being able to kind of hone in on that is beyond our immediate ability to describe it outside of Todd Lockwoodness. And then on the other end of the spectrum, it is able to perfectly ape their style, at which we have artistic tools so incredibly powerful to some extent, it does almost obviate the artist in the art process. So to me, the answer of no, it's not good enough, or yes, it is good enough, to me are both fascinating questions that have different ramifications for both the art community and the people looking to get art created.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the most promising aspect of this is how AI art can be used by artists. Because if Todd Lockwood says, hey, I want a purple dragon in my style. Okay, I'm going to take this one, this thumbnail. I'm going to take it. Let's bump it up. And then I'm going to adjust it. And now it's taken me 20 minutes to draw one of my dragons. Okay, that's great. He can bill for 5 days worth of work and it will take him 20 minutes. That's fantastic.
Or a limited purpose one. So let's take a random comic book artist. This is completely off the top of my head. Let's come up with a hypothetical artist who has no concept of how to draw feet and believes that chest muscles should be 70% of the human body and doesn't know what the eye proportions are. And all of a sudden, that artist says to themselves, and this person's name is not Rob Liefeld, and that person says to themselves, I need to draw an Art Deco car. You would now have the ability to shortchange that process of being like, oh man, I always sucked at doing these. How do I figure that in? And again, as you mentioned, there is this Todd Lockwoodness or Rob Liefeldness that the machine is able to fill in. So it also can speed up the learning process for a given artist. Now, you could also say that that shortcuts the fact that they would probably have a unique take on Art Deco cars, which has now been short-circuited by the machine. What does style mean?
So the fundamental ethical aspect to that is, if someone's art that is posted online for their commercial purposes is being scraped and used without their permission, they should get paid for that scraping, or it should be excluded, because fundamentally someone is using a piece of art, they should get paid for the use of the art, because that's a residual right. Like that is a right that they have. I know this is diving deep into copyright, but I feel that there is a path to a more ethical and healthy outcome, and I just really hope that we start moving in that direction.
So let's kind of talk about the current copyright state, because I think partially from an ethical perspective, you and I may come down in slightly different spaces. For instance, if somebody signs up for a service like ArtStation, or say, let's not use an actual one. So someone signs up for ImageHost, which is a free art image hosting site that says, in doing this, you grant us a universal, global, non-transferable, sub-licensable, irrevocable right to use this for all purposes that we deem fit. That company then has perfect rights to sell that on to be an input for Midjourney. And that is someone who, on a perfectly legal bounds, has met the requirements. But there is that ethical question, which we'll kind of get to later when we talk about, hey, what we think our best practices are. I think there is definitely a case where there is a gap between what we consider to be ethical and what we consider to be legal. In many cases right now, these models are probably breaking both. They are kind of dependent right on unsettled law. So currently in the US by and large uses a common law system. So everything I say could be easily overturned by a court ruling saying otherwise. As always, there could be new legislation. We rarely have prospective law in the United States. It is one of those things where someone says, hey, this new thing exists, and the court says, how the dink do we treat it? And that is the state of things until legislation or a future court kind of changes that. So just kind of to say where we are and why you should not take legal advice from a podcast. In the United States, the Copyright Office has a requirement of something being an original work with human authorship, must be created by a human being as a report of 2021. The word created is very messy there. Courts in the US are generally ultimately required to set those copyright standards in that it is settled through case law. One of the most notable ones was David Slater v. PETA, which was a Celebes crested macaque that David had set up a number of cameras. One of those monkeys triggered the remote shutter and took a selfie, more or less. And you have this wonderful picture of a smiling macaque monkey. I will include a link in the show notes. PETA pushed that monkey had a copyright to it. And David Slater is like, no, it was my camera. It was my setup. It was me. David Slater and PETA actually later settled out of court, but the court ruled that animals cannot hold copyright. Legal experts kind of suggest that Slater's role in the creative process should allow him to hold it. Slater went through the process of getting accepted by the troupe, befriending the monkeys, getting them to interact with the camera, and then ultimately set up the scenario by which they did it. And there are any number of performance art processes that essentially depend on random inputs from animals or the public that we very much consider to be copyrightable works.
Right.
And now it raises the question of at what point art? And we seem to have an idea that we now need to come up with a model by which we talk about the difference between the art and the artist. Now, it is also possible that since it starts with random noise, the two people could generate very similar images that are nearly identical to one another. And for the first time, we could have nearly identical pictures and both parties plausibly saying, I had no idea that the other person's work existed. At what point do we consider two images to be equivalent? At what point do we get to say a copyright claim? Do we need to hash it? Hashes are trivial to defeat. Ultimately, copyright may come down to something like copywriting the string that you use to generate it, where you say this was the random seed and these were the things to describe it. And that is what a marketplace looks like. Jason, what are your thoughts and how the dink do you think this works in America's Hat?
America's Hat is currently actually looking at prospective legislation about this. So it's currently in discussions as of 2022. Yeah, it's currently working on that and considering how AI would be handled. So a lot of the challenges I find with the monkey argument is that Midjourney, for instance, does not state that the computer is the artist. Midjourney is saying that the corporation that runs the servers holds the IP. Last I checked, the entire Disney-run commercial copyright system has fully embraced the idea that corporations can own IPs, and they're not humans.
I mean, they're persons, though.
Are they, though? Are they, like, you know...
I would love to have the corporations as persons argument. I think the one thing to keep in mind is if corporations aren't people, we no longer have newspapers because we would lose First Amendment protections and so on. So regarding that, person generated it, and in the generation process, they assign the copyright to the corporation. So the corporation itself did not generate it. When you use Midjourney, it is saying, by using this tool to the result that comes out, you are granting us a block of legal text that is not ownership, but grants a large number of rights that are transferable and repeatable.
Yes.
It is. I just want to put a little bit finer point when we say grant the IP to. Property and copyright is a bundle of sticks, and you only hand over some of them.
What is happening from a purely detailed technical perspective is I, as a human, created a prompt. That prompt is IP. That string of text is a legitimate piece of intellectual property that was transformed by a computer into an image. They granted me the license to use that computer. However, in order to do that, I have to give them the IP rights to the string of text I wrote for them. And if you're buying their services at certain levels, then the works produced are released under Creative Commons. So there is a human who created the art. That human is me, who created a line of text, who could, without computer assistance, make Gaussian blur, research 5,000 images of dragons, say, well, I'm going to look at this Gaussian blur, and there's more of a mass here, so this must be where the dragon is, and draw a dragon. It's just that middle step, which is functionally a glorified Photoshop plugin for like the healing brush patch effect that makes the process more efficient. So there is an underlying human aspect of creativity that's being licensed to a corporation, which is special, and they're licensing it back. It is a qualitatively different situation from the hypothetical, there is an abandoned camera on a path, a macaque takes it and uses it to take their own picture, which is the heart of the macaque argument.
I mean, the camera was not abandoned.
Those are the assumptions that came into the legal case. They didn't explore all of the actual realistic working with the troop, mm-hmm. aspects when they rendered that judgment. They were just looking at it as, this is a camera, this is a monkey, the monkey takes a picture of himself with that camera.
Just a note though, one of the things that becomes tricky here is Circular 33 of U.S. copyright law specifically says copyright protection is not available for names, titles, or short phrases. So the question now becomes, at what point does a prompt become not a short phrase. And so it would be interesting to get to the point where it is not. So the model at current, for instance, bans a number of phrases like particular celebrities and company names, for instance, because it does not want to tangle with trademark and trade dress infringement, which is a whole other ball of wax or whatever figure of speech you want to do. So I think until we get case law or something regarding it, I feel like it's going to fall under that short phrase exemption. So,
and then there's also, what is fair use? Does the does Midjourney have access to fair use of existing art for that it's using for its data? I don't know. There's a lot there.
Jason is mentioning is the idea of fair use, which is a doctrine in U.S. law that basically is an affirmative defense to arguments of copyright infringement that says you can use something else if you, by kind of using this multi-factor balancing test, which says, have you changed the purpose or character of the use? What is the nature of the copyrighted work? What amount of it is used? And was it a substantial amount? What is the effect on the work's value? And this is a balancing test that has come out in some real weird places. For instance, the Oracle v. Google test. In some cases, the U.S. Supreme Court ultimately decided that Google's actions satisfied all four tests for fair use, and that granting Oracle exclusive rights to use Java APIs would interfere with, rather than further, copyright basic creativity objectives. The idea was that Oracle wanted to say, hey, we have copyrighted our API for Java. You can't use it without our OK. One of my favorite bits that popped up in that case is a lower court judge taught themselves Java enough to do some basic functions to be like, is this copyrightable? Let me do some homework. So that's the kind of good jurisprudential grit that I like in my judges.
On that note, we need to stop doing the legal copyright law aside, but sure. I need to drop in a few more tidbits. A role-playing game mechanic cannot be copyrighted. It is only the expression of that mechanic. I can pick up World of Darkness and make my own Planet of Murkiness game using force instead of potence and different words for the exact same system, mechanical system. And so long as I'm expressing it in a different way with different trade dress, that's totally fine. In the same way that recipes can't be copyrighted because they're just lists. That's why cookbooks have extensive amounts of text about this is what happened when I went on my great trip to Nepal. And that's how I came up with this curry recipe, because that way they can actually copyright and protect that cookbook. So there's a lot of moving things here, and copyright is not straightforward. So yes, shall we talk about how this applies more specifically in games?
I would love to. And to start, let's just kind of give a very rapid overview of RPG art. To me, there's a couple of different types, and this is the case where you as the publisher probably going to be way more familiar with this. And to me, the question are the types and the sources. Types to me are something like cover art, then hero pieces or chapter front pieces, big iconic pieces that you will probably use more than once, but aren't necessarily the iconic image of a piece. You have interstitials, design elements, glyphs, and graphics. These are the shortcuts and motifs that are used within a book that may not be a full illustration. You have concept art, you have illustrations, and you have other art pieces, which are usually broken into half, quarter, column, or smaller element sizes. And kind of to you as an RPG publisher, are there any other fundamental types of art, of figurative visual art that you feel should be included?
Fundamental ones, maps, diagrams are also a special case. Something that is particularly strong in RPG land are the use of specific iconic characters who repeat throughout the book or the book series. Exalted, masks, etc. They all have specific characters who you will find in multiple illustrations. So those are the main things I'm thinking of. There's also a lot of gear, like just equipment is a fairly common thing that is not found in other contexts.
And to me, these have a number of different sources. These can be stock art. Literally, you go to a microstock site, you pay, you get your license, you use it however the dink you want to within the agreement for the microstock site. There is public domain, Creative Commons Zero. Do whatever the heck you want with it, or it's old enough. My favorite source of non-copyright images are the U.S. government. And when I was looking through the fall of Delta Green, I'm like, these geniuses. Because it includes a lot of government things that if you're a citizen of the U.S., it's yours too, darn it.
Just like the game Carrie, by Nathan D. Paoletta, is a game about the Vietnam War. It's got a lot of photos that are perfectly kosher for him to use.
We also have in-house artists. Some companies simply pay people to generate art all day, and those are works for hire. The company owns them. It may be another thing where it is pay for work, where the artist retains it and is merely giving a license. Some studios have a stable of artists where they're like, hey, we like working with you. We're going to ask you to do a number of one-off pieces, maybe tied to this book as one-off things. We're going to pay you a set rate. So kind of the difference between in-house artists and having as someone that you commission is that an in-house artist is usually paid a salary of some sort and is not paid per piece. You also have single piece commissions where you reach out to an artist to do a single thing. And sometimes you have the enviable case where someone in-house can already do it. We're talking about you, John Harper. Are there any other sources that kind of come up to you?
You use the term public domain, but we also need to expand that to other copyleft options. So, for instance, Creative Commons has a full range, everything from non-commercial, no derivatives, share alike, to attribution. I can use this photo of an orc and a elf drinking at a pub because the artist said, sure, you can use it. You can use it commercially. Just say that I made it. And if they say non-commercial, then I can't use it in my book, but I can use it for my own home campaign. There's something similar to stock art, which is reuse art, whereby you actively go out and ask the artist if you can buy the use of an existing piece, which functionally turns out that it's free money for the artist. So they pretty much always say, yes, I have the rights to that. Please give me money and I'll just say, yes, you can use it. And everyone's happy. I actually used that to great effect for one of my books, Sig Manual of the Primes, in that the cover art is reuse. I paid the artist a reasonable but not extravagant amount of money. I got the right to use it. It didn't require any art direction on my part. And it took me approximately 30 minutes to have a final beautiful piece of art in my hands. Wonderful. So reuse art is like stock art, but it's a bit more bespoke. It's halfway between stock art and single piece commissions.
And this is interesting in that I have done this before. I have contacted artists through ArtStation and said, hey, I would love to use this in a publication. How much do you want? And those conversations are often interesting because usually the artist is like, so how many of these do you think you're going to move? And that's kind of a fascinating thing. Well, five. Let's not shit ourselves. I'm not going to quite call this a vanity project, but we're not moving a lot. Each of these has difficulties associated with it. It is hard to find an artist of a particular style. Generic fantasy is frequently easy, but if I said postmodern surreal solar punk, there may not be an established group of artists tied to that, and it is hard to describe a new art form. It is hard to find someone who can do concept art and also finish pieces. The person who comes up with the visual language of a game is frequently not the person who does the finished pieces. A lot of games that have a setting bible, the person who came up with that, who said all the people from this faction wear clothing of this type, may have no pieces in the final book. The people that come up with the setting bibles for Magic the Gathering sets may not actually produce cards for that set. Art can take time. I can trivially describe a scene in a couple of sentences and it takes me minutes to produce, and the final piece may take hours to days. There's also a key person risk that goes with this in case the person that has created your distinctive visual style is not available for whatever reason. They've moved on to other things, their rates have become too high, or they're in some way incapacitated. And kind of an interesting—
Or milkshake duck.
Yeah. Which is to say, you have discovered this is a person that for various reasons you no longer wish to have a business relationship with outside of the functional aspects of producing a piece of art. There are a couple cases where it's like, oh, this artist is a neo-Nazi. We don't want to deal with them again, but boy howdy, they drew our signature character.
That's called, I have a new signature character now. And I am pulping the rest of my print run. Thank you very much. These are the real problems you face as a publisher.
So do you have any other problems that you've quite simply run into with traditional methods of RPG art production?
There is a need for consistency within a book, and that can be challenging to find the correct mix of artists that are going to complement each other, maintain the same mood and themes. Yes, it's possible to handle that as an art director. It's just challenging. That's part of the skill of being an art director. The other source, as you had said, one of them is art bibles. Like, you can commission someone to say, I need a visual style. Please give me these 17 things. And all of my artists are given these 17 things as a model that they have to work off. That's actually used fairly frequently in video games. They'll get a concept artist who will pop out hundreds of illustrations they pick the ones that they want, and then their in-house animators go from there to turn that into something usable.
How do you want to see AI art used? You've already experimented with a few ways of doing it and kind of laid out a few things that you consider to be the ethical guidelines. What are they, Jason?
So the ethical guidelines writ large are, one, do not use an unmodified piece of art. You should put in at least some effort into improving, modifying, clarifying, or creatively adjusting a piece of art before using it. Don't take it straight from the machine. Quite frankly, that's a practical request in a lot of cases, but it also covers off the legal requirement for a human to make art, because at that point, it is a human who is making derivative art, derivative of something in the public domain. So it's human made now. Two, do not use in the style of for any living artist who has not actively consented to having their art used in this model. This is the aforementioned Rembrandt. He has no copyright. Mm-hmm. And I am not hurting Rembrandt's sales in galleries by using Midjourney to ape his style. Todd Lockwood? No, I'm not going to do that, because I have not seen any evidence that he has actively endorsed and supported that use of his style of art. Say, great, wonderful. Not intentionally mimicking the style. Not using it to replace pieces which would otherwise be commissioned. Now, I think that this is very useful as a tool for things such as replacing stock art. Because for those in the audience who may not be aware, if you buy someone's stock art, they might see pennies. Maybe. They're not getting rich off of that. So it's not really an ethical issue of depriving the artist of anything. They're still going to get the same amount of, you know, $50 from Adobe for having their stock art up there. Replacing stock art or adding more art that you would not commission art for, I think that's perfectly fine. So long as you are not doing the painful thing of, well, we had agreed that you were going to make 20 illustrations for me, but I can get AI to do this, so I'm only going to need 3 illustrations from you. Now you can't pay for your rent, which is a very real thing that artists have been experiencing lately. People have been saying, oh, I don't need your expensive human art because I can use AI art instead, which is a shitty thing to do, just writ large. That's generally where I'm trying to draw the lines. I am not going to be decreasing the amount of money I am paying to commission art. I am going to be using this to replace stock art, public domain art, Creative Commons art, stuff that I would be using that wouldn't benefit an artist anyways. So filling in that space, I think, is an ethical way to handle it. And if I find an artist who has opted in, oh, sure, I'll use it in their style. Great. They said, go for it. I'm happy to go for it. That's sort of where I'm trying to draw the lines, because let's be real here. Artists in the role-playing game industry are not exactly getting rich. We are collectively underpaying them to a gross amount. And the only reason why they go along with it is because we tell them we will pay you money for dinner if you go draw a cool dragon with a laser-wielding knight on the back. And they go, yes, I want to draw that.
So one of the things that I see within the RPG industry is, for lack of a better term, a lot of low quality art, in the sense that you're like, oh, this is kind of a crappy cover, or this chapter frontispiece isn't really amazing. I miss the 90s and early 2000s when illustrations were more acceptable, because I feel like they were more striking, gave more information, or I may just be revealing my age as someone who grew up in the 90s and early 2000s. I think on the whole, RPG books would benefit from not necessarily changing the number of human pieces, but maybe not changing the budget, where suddenly you do 10 pieces at a higher rate as opposed to 20 pieces at a lower rate. I am always concerned about the would you have paid for it anyway argument, because that feels very close to the it's okay to pirate it if you weren't going to buy it anyway. And it's like, oh, interesting. Based on your hard drive, you were never planning on buying anything, and that somehow gives you a moral license. I kind of think that is people deluding themselves, and we can shove that off to the side. But do you think that would be ethical to be like, we are, instead of getting 20 pieces done, we are going to double the amount we pay for our keystone pieces?
Yeah, and that's perfectly fine. Okay. The amount is, I see what you're saying, but my argument is there are actual situations where someone is in negotiations with an artist. They have agreed verbally that we're going to proceed, and then they go back and say, actually, I'm going to I changed my mind. I'm going to cancel this. That's what I'm talking about.
Got it.
Which is incredibly shitty.
The other thing that I find kind of interesting is, what if someone says, well, I have $10,000 to make a book. If I can cut my art budget down to nearly zero, I can pay my writers more.
So I completely recognize this as someone who has run sub $10,000 Kickstarters. I think that rather than immediately running to AI art, it would behoove creatives to first look at some of the existing options of public domain art, Creative Commons art, buying reuse licenses. If anyone has seen my book, Sig Manual of the Primes, this is a fairly nice 240-page book with full color art scattered throughout it. My art budget for that book was $1,000 because I'm filling it with the reuse art from Julie Dillon, pieces from Gustave Doré in the public domain, etc. So I paid very little for the art. It was art director sweat equity, finding just the right public domain piece that I could use.
I like that phrase, art director sweat equity, by the way.
I think that that is a more ethical way, because if you have an ethical solution, don't use the slightly more ethically murky option, because it's easier. And quite frankly, the fact that I was using public domain art actually informed the narrative. It changed how I viewed things and how I wrote things. So it was more rewarding overall. It took more work, but I think it was worth it. And I would encourage people to go down those paths first before using AI just for monetary reasons.
It is interesting. Whenever you get something like mass automation for something, it vastly increases the supply, which reduces the price, but frequently segments the market. I think also one of the ethical things to do is to mark your publication as having used these tools. I think it is not unreasonable to allow the consumer to say, hey, I want to support works that do this, or I don't care. I feel like we should kind of be honest about those sources. I am very curious to see how this develops legally. I'm very curious to see what future models look like. For instance, I think it is perfectly possible that some of our concerns will be obviated by a model that is self-training, or in some way is strictly using Mechanical Turk or human labeled input or something, or is using training data that is strictly in the public domain, and that will remove a number of these concerns. One of the things that does worry me is, if you are training on trillions of pieces, okay, where do I send my 2/10 billionths of a cent to the artist? And it also gets into a weird space that if we do it based on volume in the training data, we could have those training sets dominated by GAN or procedurally generated art pieces. So we could have this weird case of computers paying computers. And that has an interesting mouthfeel to me.
What I would like to see is the people who are hosting these vast data sets go in and commission, like intentionally go out, do art direction work, find people and commission reuse licenses for these purposes, for vast numbers of existing pieces of work. Hey, can I pay you $200 so I can use this one specific image in our training data? No? Okay, that's fine. I think that that would be that plus all the public domain, like and the appropriate Creative Commons data sets. That becomes a much more sensible way to handle it.
To me, it's going to be one of these things where there's someone like ArtStation is going to sue. There's going to be a large settlement.
Oh, yeah.
Anyone on there is going Absolutely. To be able to participate it. I would be curious to see, though, if we can get to the point, if it is still the case that we need human-generated training data, to be like, hey, we are going to pay you a residual if you include your images every time a filter that was trained on yours is hit.
Yep.
And again, it may be fractions of a cent, but if a particular term is being used billions of times and you're part of that training set, then we can kind of get to some interesting places. But now we're going to then get into weird places where artists will have an interest in, will that prime artists to now gear their results? Almost search engine optimization for art.
Yeah.
But it could go kind of a number of weird places, and I'm curious to see where that goes. Any other thoughts before we get to one or two listener questions?
I think that art, AI generated art, is extremely useful for generating thumbnails and generating inspiration for real artists. And I'd like to see people explore that more. because I've done that. I have actively generated a dozen different pieces that are all doing concept art of this sort of style of setting, styles of composition to help inspire actual pieces being produced. And I think that's potent because that's just a random noise turning into artistic seeds that can be used.
Whenever we have an automated tool like this or a human assist tool, you have an era where it is a pale imitation of a human. You have an era where it will kind of match a person. And you then have an era where human plus machine is going to be kind of the winner, which is sometimes referred to as the cyborg period, the person machine hybrid. But eventually, in a lot of cases, there's that point where the machine is just better. I am curious to see ultimately for broad swathes of commercial art, how long we stay in each of those periods.
Yeah. One little technique that I had before Midjourney was a twinkle in the designer's eye was I used a combination of this person does not exist, which uses GAN to generate fake people used by troll farms largely. And then I ran it through Art Breeder, which is a specifically particularly strong at doing that kind of AI generated adaptations of existing photographs. So you can adjust, oh, I want this person to look older and I want to increase the hat variable. So I take a person that legitimately does not exist in a photo, then I shove it through there and I can change the art strength so it looks more painterly. And now I have a fake person who has been created from nothing, and it looks more painterly, and I've managed to make a whole bunch of NPCs. That's the kind of interesting approaches that someone can take.
What do you make of DriveThruRPG's requirement to tag products containing AI art?
AI art, I completely 100% agree. I'm a little uncertain about some of the generative tools. Like, they were clearly just trying to be broad swaths to be able to properly handle things. I'm really wondering if they're going to go back and look at all the poser art that's littered throughout DriveThruRPG publisher resources and certain catalog title images. Because there's a lot of poser art, just an older version of generated. It's the precursor.
When you say poser art, are you referring to a particular tool or are you just referring to
specifically the program Poser? It produces fairly low fidelity computer models of bodies of people. A woman with fairy wings, you can do that, and that's fairly common. And you'll see, you know, the Book of Wild Fae, and you'll see a poser model of a woman with fairy wings.
And just to note what we're talking about, DriveThruRPG is a platform for publishers to sell digital assets, whether they be PDFs or images or maps or whatever associated with their game. And now, if you're going to do this on any of the One Bookshelf services, there is a thing that says all product listings that feature are created automatically by an AI generation tool meant to bypass or replace human artistry, such as Art Breeder, Midjourney, Night Cafe, etc., are required to utilize the format creation method AI generated title filter, except in the following instances. The product is expressly approved by One Bookshelf, sure, or the art has undergone significant processing modification post-generation.
Oh, I didn't see that second one. Oh, good.
And it says you also need to include a thing for stock art that says this product contains assets that were wholly or in part procedurally generated with the aid of creative softwares powered by machine learning. So it looks like since that had started pinging around the internet, been starting to be refined. And it has a similar thing for third-party tool-generated images as well. I am pleased to see where that goes. So I think that is perfectly reasonable. I think consumers should be able to mark on it in the same way that their favorite authors I have or authors I don't want to see. Yep. And I want to be able to filter that out of my results. Do you think that Midjourney at current is good enough to threaten RPG artists? Or pardon me, are there RPG artists directly threatened by what I will say Midjourney as it stands now?
I think that RPG artists are threatened on day one because, quite frankly, the industry and our publishing models are hostile to artists.
What do you mean by that?
We radically underpay. So we don't give reliable income to artists. We don't give professional quality art direction for the most part. We don't have open bids a lot of the time. So we go out and find our same artist friend and we just work with them instead of opening things up for new artists to join us. Like, there's a long and storied tradition of indie folks who hunts down student artists because they're cheaper. I understand why. We can't fool ourselves that it was a golden age for RPG artists before Midjourney came around. No, they had to hustle like mad to make rent beforehand. This is just an extra straw on the camel's back. I'm hoping that artists are able to use it to boost their own productivity and results so that they can actually get a decent wage for the amount of time they put into to a project by decreasing the amount of time they have to put into a project.
Yeah, it is frequently the case that RPG writing or art is not bad, but the rate required to justify more time was not paid. So we run into these fantastic places where a lot of the best stuff is being done by a hobbyist who fell in love with a particular line and wants to write for it. And the fact that they're being paid peanuts is not bothering them. But anyone who's doing it professionally just needs to go, no, I can't survive on this rate. My concern is it's kind of taking out the low rungs. It is one of those things where before you generate good art, you might have to generate some crappy art, and Midjourney may be better than crappy. So it extends the degree of education and refinement before you can profit from your work. Kind of in the same way in a lot of jobs, there has been an escalation of qualification. Enough people have associate's degrees. Well, now we can demand a bachelor's. Well, enough people have bachelor's. You now need a master's in this topic, which transfers the risk from the firm onto the student, and in many cases, the student is competing against other students. So where a firm had a finite amount of risk to take on a new artist or something, you're now demanding that people functionally have MFAs or something like that before they have the level of refinement. And when you have to go that high on a skill ladder before you can actually get employed, that makes the choice more tenuous, makes the chance that you pick the wrong thing to be more disastrous, and vastly increases the cost on the people who are trying to make it. So yes, I think it is a threat, and I'm worried about the direction that will go, because if the distance you have to go to make any money in it is long enough, we will just be cutting off our own supply.
I think that the people who are using stock art as a revenue stream are going to be, they're going to have a harder time, and they're actually directly being threatened. I don't think the commissioned folks are in as much of a problem, because quite frankly, I know artists that I can go to and I will get a consistent product. I do not get a consistent product out of AI art. I get an interesting product. I get a product by the bushel, but I don't get consistent product. And as a publisher, I need consistency. I need every illustration in this book to feel like it's the same, like it's cohesive. So I think it will hit certain segments and it will hit certain artists. I'm hoping that functionally the AI cleanup art becomes a new skill that those early level artists are able to adopt, because I suspect it's not nearly as hard to clean up a Midjourney piece than it is to draw a Midjourney piece from scratch. So hopefully you wind up getting students who are paid by the hour to do cleanup work and paid a decent amount by the hour. And that produces enough quality work that everyone's happy.
It is frequently the case in the trade that what defines a job fundamentally shifts. As someone who is an actuary, if I were to look at the actuarial exams 30 years ago, part of it was, are you able to use these pre-produced tables? Are you able to do this certain type of curve fitting? We now have computer processes that do those automatically. So the level of value add that I generate as a professional has moved up to being something more refined. The tricky part often with creative works is, to what degree is that a shift in skill? So for instance, a person who is an expert at operating a typesetting machine is not necessarily a person who is an expert at typesetting itself,
right,
or graphic design and arrangement. The other thing that is particularly cruel about AI tools is the shift can be almost overnight. I am terrified for the day where we get a sufficiently skilled automatic truck driver and literally 2% of the American workforce is suddenly made redundant.
And I'd like to highlight the elephant in the room, which is, why the heck people going hungry because of market forces? Like, artists should be allowed and able to just draw art and live. But our economic system says, no, you must produce X number of widgets.
I mean, our economic system doesn't say that. Our political system says that. You and I are both in largely English-speaking North America.
Yeah, yeah.
You can have countries like the Scandinavian ones that are both more free market and more supportive of the populace. So
right.
I I feel compelled. And when we say economic,
I'm just largely in a sensible world. We have a new tool that produces, that does work for us, so we don't have to do work, would be cheered on. However, we have a society that says, you don't get to eat unless you work. So instead of people being overjoyed by automation because it lightens the load and makes their lives easier, now they're having to fight with robots for their jobs, which is unfair because computers don't need to eat. They do. So that's sort of the problem. I feel like AI art shouldn't be a problem, but the society we are within makes it a problem.
Do you feel that changes any of the answers to the questions that you had, that we posed?
Not really.
Okay.
It's just a lot of these concerns are, in truth, pointing at broader systemic problems that we can't be expected to solve. We're trying to deal with symptoms.
And I feel within the RPG industry, we do sometimes kneecap ourselves because we hold ourselves to a fundamentally different standard. And it is a question, should we do that? Do we want to make this somehow the petri dish on which we project all of our societal wants and desires when when quite simply the hobby or the trade isn't large enough to support a lot of those wants and desires? And some people can say, no, this is where it needs to start. And other people can say it is unreasonable to kneecap the things that we love in that pursuit. And to me, that is slightly beyond the scope of what we're discussing.
Yep.
But should source artists be paid? I think we answered that. One of the things to bring up is I would be fascinated if it were deemed that the training models were violating U.S. copyright law, because U.S. has statutory copyright penalties, which are in the thousands of dollars, and that could quickly represent quadrillions of dollars, which is not a number I get to normally say in the RPG industry.
Fundamentally,
yeah.
When Disney says no, this will stop. If Disney doesn't say no, this will continue. Because you need artists. You need lawyers to be able to address these kinds of things. I don't even think that ArtStation is big enough. When you get one of the big corporate dogs saying, we don't appreciate of all those images of Sonic the Hedgehog doing unseemly things to a hot dog, cease and desist all of your copyright violations. That is the kind of thing that will stop it dead in its tracks. I am neutral on if that is a good or a bad thing. I am agnostic on Sonic hot dog photos.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where when Adobe chooses to say, hey, you were training on our stock art library, that certainly changes things.
Yeah.
And I'm curious to see what falls out the other end. So do you have any concerns, given that you follow your the ethical, I'm going to say Pitt's laws.
Yep.
Do you have any concerns going forward in applying those to your next publishing products?
These are the first attempt at finding ethical ways to solve these problems. But quite frankly, we don't have enough data. The entire system is updating constantly on a daily basis. By the time this podcast releases, we might have different answers.
Yeah. The moment DALL-E 2 goes public, suddenly we are talking, the number of people threatened by this may have quintupled or something like that.
Yeah. At the time we are recording this, I think that the ethical guidelines I've pulled together should be good enough for our industry. But I'm not sure. I am open to consider other things. I am also an artist. Like I am trying to do some illustrations, and I recognize that this is a potent tool for me as an artist. So I'm excited about it from that perspective, as well as being excited as a publisher for the ability to make prettier books without forcing anyone else to do additional labor. So I'm excited about the potentials, but I don't know. I don't know if it's good enough.
We will find out. And if you develop enough thoughts on that that you wish to share with our audience again, I would love to pick up this conversation again once we have more of that data. Again, my guest today is Jason Pitt, whose last name I will never pronounce correctly.
You pronounced it pretty much perfectly.
Thank you. At Genesis of Legend on Twitter. Again, information will be in the show notes as well as to the publications that Jason mentioned earlier. Give Jason a follow if you're interested in seeing Jason's emerging thoughts on the field of AI art in RPGs, as well as some of Jason's work with Midjourney, which I have found to be interesting and delightful. Jason, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.